Live from New York City, it's The Gary Noel Show. And now, your host, Gary Noel.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Noel, and I'd like to welcome you to this program. This is going to be an empowerment hour. Today, we're going to be talking about the latest on how to manage your blood sugar using four specific herbs. Also, what's new about pomegranate? And there is a super combination of foods that can slow down the aging process. One more study supporting why vegans live a longer life. We have a lot on health and nutrition, always from original peer-reviewed literature. Then on our issues, just prior to my guest, Obama's war record from Jack Smith of Countercurrents. Clean coal, we heard the president mention it repeatedly. Well, it's a hoax. So according to Jeff Bigers, Mr. President, drop it. And then from Colin Todhunter from Global Research, he's looking at what goes on in Great Britain. It's a short commentary about living in fear and being kept in the dark. And he asks, is it any different in the United States? Well, you can respond to that. Five ways deregulation is ripping America apart. My guest will be Greg Palast. Greg is a journalist, and he's going to talk about how Mitt Romney secretly made millions and his biggest donors, billions, off the auto bailout when they seized Delphi Auto Parts in an extortion move, then moved almost all plants to China, causing 25,000 jobs to be lost. Leave it to Greg Palast, one of America's finest journalists, to uncover that. He'll be with us as well. The latest on the environment, and I'll be addressing an email from a listener. This listener is Joanna, and she has a great deal of concern about vaccines, but not because she's unsure whether she should vaccinate or not her children. It's about the pressure being applied by friends and neighbors to make her feel very irresponsible for questioning vaccine safety and efficacy. So we'll deal with that. As you see, we have a lot to cover. Let's begin. The latest on diabetes and blood sugar is that there's some herbs that have been scientifically proven to help you maintain your blood sugar. And one is called Hindi, H-I-N-D-I. It means sugar destroyer. And it's one of the most powerful herbs for the regulation of diabetes, both type 1 and type 2. It can help you cut down your cravings for sugar or sweets. And the studies show it can actually stimulate the body to produce more of its own insulin by regenerating insulin-making beta cells in the pancreas. And that's good. Generally, the dose is 2 to 250 milligrams twice a day. It also goes by the name Gymnema sylvestra, G-Y-M-N-E-M-A-S-Y-L-V-E-S-T-R-E. Also, good old ginkgo biloba. It is a terrific herb. Most people use it to increase microcirculation to the brain or to the extremities, especially if you have cold feet or hands, if you have an underactive thyroid. And indeed, it does help. But ginkgo is also important for treating vascular insufficiency, and that relates to diabetes, where poor circulation can have severe consequences. Studies have shown that ginkgo, G-I-N-G-K-O, biloba, B-I-L-O-B-A, can prevent diabetic retinopathy. And in the experiments they did. And that's similar to what would happen in humans. So another good reason to use it. Then probably one of the most widely used herbs in the world, but not widely used in the United States, ginseng. Chinese medicine has used ginseng for thousands of years. It is called an adaptogen. It can help your body adapt to many different things. It can be used to help release insulin from the pancreas, to elevate the number of insulin receptors present. About 200 milligrams of ginseng per day over an 8-week period helped improve mood, blood sugar, and body weight and energy levels in type 2 diabetics. So it's very good. Now, I remember ginseng farmers where I grew up in West Virginia, very hilly country, and they would go out generally on a Saturday or a Sunday. I did it many times myself. And you just climb up the hill and you have a what was more often than not a broom without the broom on the end. It just cut the broom off. You wanted about a 6-foot stick, and you just move the leaves back and forth, the brush back and forth, A, because you didn't want to get bit by a copperhead. It's a very silent snake, blends right into the terrain. So that got him out of the way, because you were looking for the ginseng root. Now, wild ginseng can get very, very large, and they sold it by the ounce. And people were making thousands and thousands of dollars a year by picking up ginseng. And West Virginia is one of the largest producers of wild ginseng in the world. And people just don't know it. And finally, we have what's called nopal leaves, N-O-P-A-L, nopal. And studies show that this is a Mexican herbal remedy. They use it in Mexico for everything, improving blood sugar, lowering cholesterol, helping prevent cardiovascular disease, even cancer. And generally they serve it in salads or stir-fried dishes and has a richness to it. It's a functional food. It helps function the body in a very good way. It's rich in fiber and pectin and vitamin C, vitamin K, minerals like folic acid. And so you can use those, but also if you're diabetic, also eat lots of onions and garlic for a simple reason. Onions and garlic both contain sulfur-containing allyl propyl disulfide. This helps the body to make better use of insulin, which is also a disulfide, and in by competing with it for insulin inactivity sites in the liver. So it's all good for you. And don't forget magnesium, 800 to 1,000 milligrams a day, and chromium, generally 200 micrograms a day. Now, for those of you who've been using your green powders each day, one more study showing you have been way ahead of the curve. This is from the American Association of Pharmaceutical Scientists. They just had a meeting yesterday in Arlington, Virginia, and it was put forth, and I'll quote this, a new compound created from a rich source of vegetables, including broccoli and Brussels sprouts. Sounds like cruciferous things, doesn't it? And it showed that these are the world's largest sciences that were there, and they found that this was very, very important in helping a lot of the biochemical activity in the body. And they found that it was very good in helping with breast cancer. In fact, even superior to anything they had. This is from a Dr. Sakdeva, a Dr. Gaduku, and from Florida A&M University, in collaboration with Dr. Stephen Safe from Texas A&M. They evaluated the activity of the CDIM derivatives that come from these vegetables, and they found that it had, quote, superior anti-cancer activity. Well, how about that? So they're now figuring out that naturally occurring compounds in cruciferous vegetables can help with cancer, like indole-3-carbinol. Yeah, that's one they didn't even mention. So one more reason to keep using your cruciferous vegetables each day. Over a 10-year period in the state of New Jersey, we would argue that nutritionists and chiropractors and others who had a background in health sciences should be allowed to offer advice to patients wanting a nutritional input. And we won until one of the people who had been backing the legislation switched and voted against our side and for the American Dietetic Association, making it a requirement that you had to be a licensed dietitian, which means you have to take all these hours. I believe it depends on which state, but 900 or more hours, which is a lot of time, in a hospital setting or in a dietetic setting, beyond your schooling and all your required classes in nutritional biochemistry and inorganic chemistry and organic chemistry and dietetic sciences and all the other courses you have to take in physiology and anatomy. And so then it became the law in New Jersey and in New York and Connecticut. But they really are now taking it to the next stage in North Carolina. This is from the Alliance for Natural Health, and I'll quote it. It says, a journalist in North Carolina undercovers the Dietetics Board campaign to limit free speech and competition. I'll quote it. Working on a tip, a reporter discovers internal documents detailing the true motives of the Dietetics Board. In July, we reported that the North Carolina Board of Dietetics and Nutrition is being sued because the board wanted to prevent a blogger, Steve Cooksey, from offering free nutrition advice based upon personal experience, even to his friends, over the telephone. So let me put this in context. A guy has some experience improving their health and calls up a friend and says, I just want to tell you what I did for myself. And see if this helps you. And they're saying, you can't do that. And you're thinking, what do you mean you can't do it? How in the world could you possibly intervene in someone expressing an experience they had about an improvement in their health? They're not charging for it. It's a friend. It's over the telephone. When I tell you we're becoming a police state and you kind of yawn, this is proving it. And especially the American Dietetic Association. They are so compromised on so many levels. I'll continue. And it says that now it turns out the reporter has spoken with many people investigated by that board in North Carolina and learned that the Cooksey case was just the tip of an iceberg. The North Carolina Board of Dietetics and Nutrition has been involved in the investigation and surveillance of nearly 50 people, including over the past 5 years, including the Duke University Integrative Medicine Department. Now, the reporter for the Carolina Journal, Sarah Burroughs, who got the documents, said that they're now being accused of a, quote, crime, practicing nutrition without a license. Now, according to Burroughs, the board, which is supposed to represent licensed professionals working in the field of diet and nutrition, quote, is interested in anyone who gives advice about what people should eat. If the accused is found guilty of, quote, assessing someone's dietary needs or counseling that person as to what they should eat without a license, they are told to stop. If they refuse, they could be indicted and convicted and sent to jail on a misdemeanor. The American, the Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics, which was formerly the American Dietetic Association, which, by the way, gets all this money from junk food companies and has stated repeatedly that the organization is not against people sharing nutrition information. Really? Well, not true, because now they have found out that they're behind the scenes in every single state. In North Carolina, if people say, quote, people should avoid sugar, that's okay, you're allowed to say that. But if you say, if you have diabetes, you should avoid sugar, then you're guilty of a Class 1 misdemeanor, which is punishable by fines and prison time. State nutrition boards that are controlled by, in effect, the American Dietetic Association often pursue complaints against nutrition and health professionals who are not registered dietitians. In some states, registered dietitians who file complaints against other nutritionists actually receive prizes. Now, the finding gives scientists a reason to rethink current ways of treating mental illness and other conditions. In any case, so if you are a person in North Carolina, just be aware that if you give free advice to a friend, a family member, if a wife tells the husband, you got to cut down on the sugar because it's associated with diabetes, you could go to jail. How about that for North Carolina? Now, for those of us like myself who are registered dietitians, and nationally and statewide, I can practice anywhere I want, and a PhD, and a nutritionist, that doesn't impact us. But boy, it does in those states like North Carolina. Because what they're doing, they're making it so only a registered dietitian. Well, the fact is 95% of dietitians don't know diddly squat about anything, in my opinion. And in fact, I had dietitians came to my college. I had only a really accredited program, truly an independent program through Edison State College, where you could get a degree in a nutrition from a holistic perspective. It took 4 years to do, but we had people do it. We had more students wanting to get in than we had even seats in the college for them to get in. And those are many of the people now who are working as licensed clinical nutritionists with their legitimate accredited degrees and their dietetics degrees in doctor's offices and around the country in health food stores, etc. But they want to make it so that no one else can offer free nutrition counseling. Imagine what that would do. Oh yeah, that would also impact broadcasters. I wouldn't be able to do this show, nor would anyone else, if we weren't registered dietitians. You have to understand the game they play. It's all bad to the bone. One more reason to support your holistic nutritionist and try to encourage those dietitians to become holistic. That would be a good move on their part. Multiple vitamins reduce cancer risk in some men. This is from Medical News in the Journal of the American Medical Association. It says middle-aged and older men who regularly take multiple vitamins were found to have an 8% lower risk of developing cancer compared to other men of the same age who took no multiple vitamins. This was done at Harvard Medical School. All right, they looked at 15,000 male doctors for this. Well, now, A, these are doctors, and what they did not measure, they didn't measure what happens if they get individual health counseling so that they have a trained professional look at your blood chemistry to determine what are you deficient in. Do you have an elevated homocysteine level? Well, we've got to give you extra folic acid and methylated B12 and vitamin B6 at 300 or 400 milligrams and trimethylglycine at 1,000 milligrams. Bring that down. No looking at that, just regular multiple vitamins. So if they had an 8% reduction of developing cancer with just a regular weak multiple vitamin, imagine how much better they would be if they took all those phytonutrients and other antioxidants and vitamins. That would be terrific. I'm Gary Knoll. We're here to talk about the issues that make a difference. And because I have so much to talk about today on so many other issues, plus going to our guest, I'm going to go directly to some commentaries. None of these commentaries are my own. I will tell you who they're from. The first is from Colin Todhunter from Global Research. And it's entitled, British Democracy, Living in Fear, Kept in the Dark. It's short. Let me quote it. Earlier this year, I watched the BBC's main political debate program that allows an audience of members of the public to put questions to a panel of politicians and the so-called experts. Syria was on the agenda. A member of the panel referred to the Syrian rebels as freedom fighters. Within a few minutes, all the panel members and the audience were using this term to refer to the rebels. It led me to ponder why so many people were willing to accept at face value an agenda that portrayed the insurgents in such a wholly positive light. It also led me to conclude just how easy it is to manipulate ordinary people into backing imperialist ventures abroad, which are fought on behalf of the richest interest. At a time of biting austerity and attacks on workers in the welfare state, well over £1 billion of ordinary people's money was used to fund the illegal bombing of Libya. The justification sold to the public for such militarism is that dictators are bad. The justification sold to people for attacking or destabilizing countries, resulting in mass death of those innocent people, is that democracy must therefore be forced through the barrel of a gun. isn't it terrible? The politicians and media say that Assad is a brutal dictator who is preventing democracy by putting down the rebels. The Assad regime undoubtedly has its faults, but nothing is ever said by the corporate media about the authoritarian ruling clique in Saudi Arabia, which has been given its name to that country, the House of Saud. Nothing is ever said about a Western-backed dictator in Bahrain, who has been in power for 52 years. Nothing is ever revealed about the brutal ongoing crackdowns on protesters and dissenters in those countries. When Bahrain used Saudi troops to put down uprisings last year, the resultant death toll was proportionally much larger than was the loss of life in Egypt during the uprising there. In fact, if the death toll in Bahrain were taken as a proportion of the population, the equivalent death toll for Egypt would have been 12,000 dead. Where was the outraged diplomats, politicians, and media from the United States and its client states? That's right, there was none. The King of Bahrain was even invited to attend Queen Elizabeth's Jubilee celebration at Buckingham Palace. As if it did in Libya, repressive Saudi Arabia is playing a big role in facilitating the ragtag rebels in Syria to destabilize a sovereign state that stands in the way of NATO and Israeli interest. A far away and back in Britain, the public is being fed a pack of lies by politicians in the mainstream media about the situation in Syria, just as it's been over other military adventures over the past decade. The majority of British citizens don't have much of a clue about what's happening. They are unaware that Syria forms part of a greater game in the region. They fail to see the links between Syria, Pakistan, Libya, Afghanistan, Iraq, and Iran, which are all part of a Washington-led wider geopolitical strategy, hell-bent on global domination, controlling the world's mineral resources and pipeline routes, and lining the pockets of Western financiers and oil and armaments and logistics companies. Too many remain confused or ignorant thanks to duplicitous politicians and corporate media. The public cannot know the reality. They will not be allowed to know. They must be kept in fear and in the dark and deceived by politicians and the media that churn out increasingly tired-sounding clichés about a war on terror or humanitarian militarism to justify murderous brutality. And the result is that too many people accept the lie that ragtag forces made up of vicious, faction-ridden fighters, illegally armed by NATO, terror governments, and unelected regimes in Saudi and Qatar are fighting for freedom and democracy. Those forces and nations wouldn't know freedom and democracy if they fail over it. Sorry, my mistake. They would and they do. That's why they seek to crush it when it appears. And that applies whether it appears within the borders of the U.S., Britain, or Saudi, or elsewhere in places that are of strategic importance to them. The U.S. track record of crushing democratic governments is well documented by the likes of Noam Chomsky and historian William Blunt. And look no further to see the attacks on WikiLeaks or the Occupy movement to see how democratic movements are treated at home. Look no further to see how democratic workers' movements that took hundreds of years to build in Britain and elsewhere in Europe are under sustained attack. Giving the people the opportunity to vote every 4 or 5 years, while in the meantime deceiving, misinforming, and lying to them has no more to do with democracy or freedom than what is happening in Syria right now. If more ordinary folk were to turn their attention away from glossy sports events, premiership football, cheap knockout television shows, we would all be better served. End quote. Now to Jeff Bigers from Common Dreams. A short piece, a commentary, clean coal is a hoax, Mr. President, so drop it. I'll quote this. Out of all the meaningless slogans bantered around this election season, President Obama's clinging to the clean coal banner ranks as one of the most specious. Clean coal is a hoax, and the president knows it. And outside of appeasing a few Midwestern big coal sycophants and his Duke Energy coal buddy Jim Rogers, who helped underwrite the Democratic Convention this summer in Charlotte, Obama has little to gain from invoking the offensive phrase. You're offensive, Mr. President, to use your own words. Offensive to coal miners and their families who have paid the ultimate price. Offensive to people who live daily with the devastating impacts of coal mining and coal ash in their communities and watersheds. And the offensive to anyone who recognizes this spiraling reality of climate change. If Ameren, one of the biggest coal-supporting utility companies in the nation, can throw in the towel and admit it doesn't work on future, again, clean coal boondoggle in Obama's adopted state of Illinois, then why can't our president at least state the truth during his election or drop the sloganeering? The coal is clean. It is not. It's sad enough to watch the president mock Republican Mitt Romney for his dead-on realization once upon a time that coal-fired plants kill. It's even sadder as our nation drifts along in titanic denial towards climate destabilization for a president to crow about being a friend of a deadly rock. And it's downright tragic for Obama apologists, all of whom live in Washington, D.C. or non-coal mining areas, to turn a blind eye to Obama's unleashing of massive coal mining permits in the Powder River Basin to the regulated humanitarian and health disaster of mountaintop removal in Appalachia and the destructive operations of longwall mining for farm communities in the heartland. Coal is not and will never be clean, Mr. President, and all of your apologists know it. Mitt Romney was right, at least on this. Coal kills. Coal kills three miners every day, as black lung has spiked during the Obama administration. Coal mining and burning pollutants contribute to four of the five leading causes of death in the United States, according to Physicians for Social Responsibility. Heart disease, cancer, stroke, and chronic lower respiratory diseases. Their conclusion emerges from a reassessment of the widely recognized health threats from coal. Each step of coal life cycle, mining, transportation, washing, combustion, and disposing of post-combustion waste impacts human health negatively. Coal slurry, coal ash, mercury, strip mining, silicosis, the deadly list goes on. President Obama, stop using the clean coal slogan. And finally, from Jack Smith, Countercurrents, Obama's War Record. When Senator Barack Obama ran for the presidency in 2008, many wishful-thinking Democratic voters viewed him as a peace candidate because he opposed the Iraq War. But he voted yes on the war budgets while in the Senate. Some others assumed his foreign military policy would be along the lines of President Bush, the first Bush, George H.W. Bush, who President Obama admires, or Bill Clinton. Some who identified as progressives actually thought his foreign military policy might tilt to the left. Instead, center-rightist that he is, Obama's foreign military policy amounted to a virtual continuation of George Bush's global war on terrorism under a different name. He extended Bush's wars in Pakistan, Yemen, Somalia, Libya, and elsewhere, while greatly expanding the war in Afghanistan, hiking the military budget, encouraging the growth of militarism in the U.S. society by repeatedly heaping excessive praise on the armed forces and tightening the military's encirclement of China. Summing up some of his military accomplishments a few months ago, Obama declared, quote, "We've succeeded in defending our nation, taking the fight to our enemies, reducing the number of Americans in harm's way, and we've restored America's global leadership." Really? Obama actually has little to show for his war policy after 4 years. Most importantly, Afghanistan, the war he supported with enthusiasm, is predictably blowing up in his face. A symbol of the Bush-Obama 11-year Afghan folly is the recent 2,000 death of an American soldier. The truth is that the public opinion in Afghanistan has always been overwhelmingly opposed to the invasion, and rightly so. Obama hopes to avoid the embarrassment of a takeover by the Taliban or any other violent Afghan civil war individuals about after the bulk of U.S. troops pull out at the end of 2014. He's made a deal with the Kabul government that allows Washington to keep thousands of American troops, Army, CIA agents with their drones, elite special operation forces and pilots until 2024. There are two reasons for this. One is to keep U.S.-controlled government in Kabul as long as possible. The other is to station American combatants near Afghanistan's border with Iran to the west and China to the east for another 10 years, a verdict hardly appreciated in Tehran or Beijing. The Middle East is in turmoil. Israel's still threatening to attack Iran, an act that would transform turmoil into catastrophe. The Syrian regime refuses to fall, much to Washington's chagrin. Egypt's new government has just declared partial independence from Washington's long-standing domination. The plight of the Palestinians has worsened during Obama's presidency. Relations with China and Russia have declined. Very few of Obama's foreign military election promises have come to fruition. He said he would initiate a new beginning in relations with the international Muslim community, which had reached a low point under Bush. America's popularity jumped after the president promising Cairo speech 2009, but now, after repeatedly attacking Muslim countries with drone assassins, the rate is 15%. That's lower than when Bush was in command. Obama had promised to improve relations with Latin America and get diplomatically closer to Iran and Cuba and settle the Israeli-Palestinian dispute and close Guantanamo prison, among a number of unrealized intentions. All the foreign developments the Democrats could really brag about at their convention were ending in the war of Iraq with heads held high as our legions departed an eight-year stalemate conflict that cost us $4 trillion. So what do we really have to show? In conclusion, actually, Bush ended the war in Iraq by signing an agreement with the Baghdad regime before the new president took office to pull out all U.S. troops at the end of 2011. Obama supported the treaty, but tried unsuccessfully until the last minute to coerce the Iraqis to keep many thousands of American troops in the country indefinitely. Obama, as warrior president, discombobulated the Republicans who in past elections always benefited from portraying the Democrats as weak on defense. Efforts to do this year have fallen flat after the president, in effect, melted down his undeserved Nobel Peace Prize to make more bullets. Obama also obtained a second dividend. He wasn't besieged by anti-war protest, as was his predecessor, because most anti-Bush peace Democrats would not publicly oppose Obama's militaristic policies. This essentially destroyed the mass U.S. anti-war movement, which has been kept going on a much smaller scale by the pacifists and some members of the left. Throughout Obama's election declarations, he occasionally speaks of and exaggerates increasing threats and hazards confronting the American people that only he can manage. He told the convention that, quote, new threats and challenges are facing the country. Historian, academic Andrew Bacevich, an Army colonel in Vietnam and now strongly opposed to America's wars, mentioned fear-mongering in an article published in the January issue of The Atlantic magazine. He writes, "The national security state derived its purpose and vigorously promoted a belief in the existence of looming national peril. What worked during the Cold War, the fear of communist menace and nuclear war, still works today to get Americans on board with your military policy and scare the hell out of them." End quote. I'm Gary Knoll. Let's go over and say hello to our guest who is standing by, Greg Palast. Hi, Greg. Nice to have you with us today.
Hi, Gary. Hectic day, yes.
Greg, let's go through this very quickly. Greg's on as a newsmaker today because he just brought out a report about secretly making millions of dollars for Romney personally and billions for his friends, and at the same time saying that he wouldn't have saved the auto industry from closing up. And yet, tell us what the truth is about what he made and how he did it.
Yes, this is the cover story of The Nation magazine just released today. A story actually you and I have talked about, but now I can fill in more details. As it turns out, Mitt Romney personally made tens of millions of dollars off the auto bailout. He did this secretly as the silent partner of the Vulture Fund, as it's called, the Vulture Fund of Paul Singer, the billionaire who is his chief donor. And the three billionaires, hedge fund managers working in coordination, they made $4 billion, $4.2 billion on the auto bailout. Romney got his slice silently. And what the great tragedy of it all is that they did this through a, frankly, what I would call a financial flimflam, legal, I'm not saying it's not, a legal financial flimflam, which resulted in the entire auto parts division of General Motors, used to be called Delco, became Delphi, has been shut down and moved lock, stock, and barrel to China. So that General Motors, the biggest auto parts supplier, General Motors, Delphi, which used to produce, be part of GM and produce from Michigan and Ohio, is now importing all, it's now bringing all its parts from China. And this is all the Mitt Romney operation. They moved, they not only moved the auto plants from Michigan to China, they moved the company's incorporation from Troy, Michigan, to the Isle of Jersey in the English Channel, which is a little island tax haven. So all this stuff is well hidden and, by the way, of course, untaxed. So billions for Romney's donors. And by the way, each of those donor, each of those billionaires who made another billion each on the bailout, each gave Romney also a donation for his campaign of $1 million each. So he got $1 million each in donations. He got tens of millions. The numbers we're looking at is $15 million minimum, more likely $115 million. And, of course, his buddies made billions. And at the meantime, because obviously it's all been quite quiet, he talked about how he was against the auto bailout giveaway. There you go.
Well, that says it. So you have Romney's billionaire partner, Paul Singer, and his vulture fund, Elliott Management, made the super profits using methods called extortion by insiders. Yep. So when do you think this will come up so that people will know the truth about how absolutely sleazy this man is?
You know what? As usual, even though it's Nation, which is, you know, a pedigree outfit, and the investigation started for BBC television when I was in the Congo tracking Paul Singer, the vulture. We have BBC, we have The Guardian, we have The Nation. I cannot get mainstream U.S. press to touch it. It's just radioactive. And, you know, I'm not here to elect Obama. And I just want this information to come out. And one of the problems is that they're saying, you know, this is partisan. It's not partisan. I'm certainly, like you, Gary, I'm certainly no big fan of Obama by any means. In fact, if you read Billionaires and Ballot Bandits, you'll find stories about Obama's billionaires who are pretty creepy, and they've gotten their slice of America through their connection, believe me. But, you know, this story has got to come out, and I'm glad that you're bringing it out. And I don't know how else to do it. I hope people listening will, you know, go to nation.com and read the rest and go get the full story in the book Billionaires and Ballot Bandits, which also explains all the other operations of Singer the Vulture and his connections to the Romneys. And, you know, hopefully we can get this word out. But this, by the way, $12 billion is what this cost the U.S. Treasury. For these guys to make $4 billion, we paid $12 billion. We lost all the jobs. And, you know, people's lives have been ruined because a lot of Delphi workers lost big hunks of their pensions. I talked to a family that just went into bankruptcy and foreclosure. You know, so I hope Mr. Romney's happy with his extra millions, because he talks about these families who have been in distress. Well, I got to tell you, I talked to a family in distress, and Mitt Romney never called them and said, gee, I'll help you out, because he's the one who has their money. They wouldn't be in distress. It's in his pocket.
Greg, thank you for doing this important work and expose, and please, to this audience, take a look at thenation.org to read Greg Palast's new article in there concerning Mitt Romney and Romney's secret made millions. All the best to you.
Thank you. Thank you, Gary. And I should mention at the back of Billionaires and Ballot Bandits are the media resources that I believe you can trust. Gary Noel Show and PRN are there. Thank you for being the outlet for real information. It really makes a difference. Thanks, Gary.
Take care. I'm Gary Noel. We're now going to go over and say hello to Joe Mangano for a little newsmaker update. Joe Mangano is the executive director of the Radiation and Public Health Project, which is a nonprofit organization founded by scientists and physicians to understand the relationship between low-level nuclear radiation and public health and the risks of diseases like cancer and damage to newborn. Joe's published numerous articles and letters in the medical and other journals. He has a book called Low-Level Radiation and the Immune System Disorders, and there he examines the connection between radiation and Joe's website is radiation.org, and any support that the people in this audience can give to this organization, I think would be absolutely at the top of your list of places to help because they do great work. Nice to have you with us today, Joe.
Likewise, Gary. Good to talk to you.
Joe, I want to address those apologists for the nuke industry who are always saying, well, it can't be that all these nuclear power plants are dangerous. So I'm going to just ask you three questions. And if you would, in this short newsmaker segment, provide us with your answers, your expertise, and documentation.
Sure.
I claim that every single one of the 104 nuclear reactors in the United States emits radiation. I claim that there is no such thing as safe radiation, that even so-called low-level radiation, according to Professor John Goffman, MD, PhD, and arguably the America's greatest scientist on the subject of low-level radiation, says there's no such thing as safe low-level radiation. And three, I claim that there are leaks all the time at these plants, and that even giving off toxic water into the water system, which kills fish by the billions throughout our country, is also another way that they upset the ecological system. Tell me if my statements are accurate or not, and what your position is, and what does the scientific literature show on this?
If I was your professor, Gary, you would get an A on all three. Let's start with the first one. Any claim that there are no releases from nuclear power reactors is incorrect. In fact, even among the nuclear operators, there's a term, ALARA, ALARA, as low as reasonably achievable. You can't operate a nuclear reactor without emitting some of the radiation that's created. And the proof of this is very simple. It's the United States Nuclear Regulatory Commission's website. It's a system they have called REIRS. I'm sorry for all the acronyms. But they have, for virtually all reactors in the U.S., from 2001, each quarter, 2001 to 2007, most recently, the actual amounts of gaseous and liquid emissions into the environment of various types of radiation, iodine, tritium, alpha emitters, and so on. So that's number one. They release. They are below what the government claims is a permissible limit. However, we have to be careful because, number one, that leads into number two. Is there a safe level of radiation? Just because it's within government limits doesn't mean it's safe. As a matter of fact, there are numerous articles beginning in the late 1950s which took the assumption that low doses were safe and turned them on their ear, starting with the studies of pregnant women that got pelvic x-rays. And Dr. Alice Stewart found that children that were exposed in utero had had almost twice the chance of dying of cancer by age 10. There are no safe levels. Obviously, the higher the exposure, the greater the risk. There's a blue ribbon panel, I'm sorry for another acronym, called the BEIR, B-E-I-R 7 panel. They get together every couple of years. The last report is 2005, based on hundreds of scientific articles. They concluded once again that there is no safe level. And the third question, does a reactor leak all the time? Yes, it does. Every single day there are emissions, both accidental and deliberate, into the environment. It's a relatively small portion of the waste that remains inside the reactor and must be kept away from people for hundreds and thousands of years, but it's an everyday thing. You just can't create electricity from the core into the steam generators and into the grid without allowing some of it to leak out through stacks, basically, which are like smokestacks in the reactor. And sometimes it's done deliberately, like when they change the fuel rods every year or two. There's a operators deliberately release radioactivity into the local water. I want to be brief, so I'll stop here if you want me to follow.
No, you've said it all. I just wanted this as a newsmaker update, but I am going to invite you back. We're going to do a complete updated show on our Progressive Commentary Hour. And so Richard Gower, producer, will be in touch with you so we can extend this discussion about the consequences of safety at these factories or at these utility complexes and what happens if there's a solar storm and what happens if there's an earthquake and how vulnerable are we and what's really happening now with Fukushima, when we just heard yesterday that the very damaged but still standing third building has sunk 3 feet. And the scientist said it's absolutely certain it's going to collapse. What will that mean? All this we want to talk with you about on the upcoming Progressive Commentary Hour. All right?
I'll be very happy to join you, Gary.
Thank you very much, Joe. Joe Mangano, M-A-N-G-A-N-O. And please support radiation.org. They can use it. I've known Joe for a long time. And I've supported his group and continue to do so. I'd like for our audience to support him also. I'll see you soon, Joe.
Yeah, Gary. All the best.
Back in a moment. Please stay with us. Be with us, everyone. Still more to come, but we're going to take a simple break. I wasn't anticipating this, but Dr. Roy Spicer called in and had some good news, well, at least for 10 people. Dr. Spicer's on the line. Hi, Roy.
Hello, Gary.
Okay, you found 10 of the water portable 3-gallon water filter units that had been set aside for this office, for, I guess, people in the office. So you're not completely gone on everything, so we have 3 units, right?
That's correct.
Okay, then let me just offer this up real quick. For those who heard me discuss the other day how to survive a crisis, a catastrophe, a hurricane, earthquake, solar storms that are coming in the next 6 weeks, a nuclear meltdown from an accident, a terrorist attack, or from a solar storm, I put together a kit. The kit contains a book, a very important book, on everything you need to know, everything you need to have, plus a 3-gallon portable water filtration system that you can purify water anywhere you go. But also, last evening, I went into studio and I finished the 3-hour detailed, comprehensive analysis of how to survive whatever happens. And that is going to be the center of so much. In fact, when you start listening to this three-hour CD, not a single second is wasted. I tell you everything, where to go, what are the best states, which are the worst states, with Matthew Stein, who is a mechanical engineer from MIT and a National Merit Scholar and an expert on the subject. We discussed, what do you have to have in your home, your apartment? What if you're single, have a family? What if you're an invalid? What if you don't have a car, if you do have a car? What if you live in New York City? What if you live in L.A.? Where do you go? How do you get there? Everything you need to know to survive is in a three-hour CD. It could be the single most important 3 hours you've ever listened to, and it's done. Today, they're just putting the music on, and my art director is getting the artwork ready, and it's finished. It'll go out in another 2 days. So for the first time, I'm offering 3-hour CD with Matthew Stein and myself, How to Survive a Crisis. The solar storms are coming. That's without dispute. We just don't know how bad they will be. But if they're bad, people are going to be creamed, and then it'll be too late. Then we also know that with radical weather, with extreme weather, it could be extreme, and we wouldn't know what to do. So what if an earthquake comes? What do you do? What do you do if you're at home and your family's at somewhere else? How do you communicate? How do you go to where you need to go? Should you go north or west or east or south? How do you get there? Do you go home and lock yourself in? What do you need to survive for a week, a month, a year, or longer? Every single thing that I know to help you survive, the very things I'm using, and I'm way ahead of it, are in this 3 hours. Three solid packed hours, plus a complete description of a solar storm and the nuclear meltdown that could come, and the how much it would cost the nuclear industry and the utility industry to fix up their system to prevent this, but they're not going to do it. So we can no longer rely upon our government, state, county, federal, to help us. We're on our own. So knowing this, the top survivalist, Matthew Stein, and myself, we put together the 3 hours. So that you can get by itself. 3 hours. $29.95. I'm going to give you the number. You'll call this number now. And also, for $185, you'll be able to get the whole kit, including what normally is, it's $240 normally just for the water filtration system that you got to have. There's nothing more important. And Matthew and I both said, you got to have a water filtration system no matter where you're at, because you may have no water except out of a river, a stream, a swimming pool, the back of a toilet bowl. You've got to be able to drink. You can't go more than a few days without water. And most people don't realize that no water in their apartment house is going to work. No gasoline is going to be pumped. No traffic will work. No, you won't be able to get money out of a bank. Everything electronic is going to go dead if the power goes out. And you don't know how long. If it's a severe storm, it will never come back, because we explain why we can't get the power back on. Why this isn't like a hurricane or a tornado. This is really devastating if it goes that bad. And it could. It has twice before. And we're on a 9-year cycle. We're overdue. And we're on a 12-year cycle. So I trust nothing the authorities tell me at this point. So I'm planning. Hope you're smart enough to plan. So the 3-hour CD, the book, and the water filter, normally that would cost you about $290. You bought them separately, $185 for this audience. Today, I only have 10. That's it. You can only buy one. I've got 10, then I'm out. Or you can get the 3-hour CD for $29.95. That's it. All the money goes to the station. None goes to me. I'm doing this as a public service. So call this number now. We only have 10. Of the whole unit, the water filtration unit, which is absolutely crucial. This isn't one of those little dinky things. This is a 3-gallon thing. This is for a family. It can get your water, and not just one little gallon. You could filter 1,000 gallons of water with this one 3-gallon unit. This isn't like having a 3 gallons and that's it. This is a filter. You just keep using it and using it, and you can clean it. Call 877-627-5065. 877 877-627-5065, 877-627-5065, and we will get you out in the next 2 to 3 days, the whole kit, including, brand new, just finished it at 1 o'clock this morning, the 3-hour, absolutely necessary for everyone to have, how to survive a crisis, a catastrophe, solar storm, nuclear meltdown, earthquake, flooding. It's all in there. Everything you need to know, no matter what your background. 3 hours. We literally came, I'd have done a fourth hour, but I came to a point where I couldn't give any more, and he couldn't. We gave everything we know. So that's by itself, $29.95. You can get that by itself, or you can get the whole kit. We only have 10, and that's it. Then I'm out. It's over, 877-627-5065. Roy Spicer, by the way, Roy, just for people who are curious, give us your academic background and why you're an expert in being able to say things about water purification and why people who drink, you know, unfiltered water are really risking health consequences.
Well, my background includes a major in zoology. I have a bachelor's degree. I have a master's in biochemistry and a PhD. And my first job was with the New Jersey Department of Health as a bacteriologist. That's my major training, and I work with enteric diseases, which are intestinal diseases, which are commonly found in water in the United States related to parasites. And parasites are commonly found in all surface water systems, including New York City's water system. And it's a major problem, especially for people with weakened immune systems. So even the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control, and the EPA advise people to protect themselves either by boiling water or using an appropriate filter, which would have to be a ceramic filter capable of removing parasites and bacteria, which is in the emergency filter. So this is published on all water reports. It's a requirement by the Clean Water Drinking Act. So if you even go online and look up waterborne disease, you'll see the CDC, Centers for Disease Control.
We're running out of
publishing.
Time. I need you to answer. By the way, where did you get your PhD?
Rutgers University.
Great school. Great school. All right, so you got all the academic background. You got all the professional experience in the field. You're up on every single article. One quick question. Is it accurate or inaccurate to say that every single water municipality in the United States could end up having contaminants in it that the public wouldn't know when they're drinking it? Bacteria, viruses, parasites, nanomedical particles, or other pollutants?
Yes, but Gary, every day there's bacteria and parasites in the drinking water from every surface water source in the United States. That's a fact.
Okay. And this water filter, what will it get out?
This will reduce parasites 100%, bacteria 99.99%, particulates, dirt, rust, and sediment, and it'll remove bad taste and odors and chlorine.
So would you say then if someone were using this water filter, portable water filtration system, if there's an emergency, they could go to a river, they could go to a lake, they could go to a swimming pool, whatever water, they could use that water, filter it, and be able to drink it and stay healthy?
Yes, Gary. It's used worldwide exactly for that purpose, and non-potable water will create potable water.
Okay. Dr. Roy Spicer, thank you for sharing that. So that's it. I don't know how many we have left because I'm out on the road. But we had 10 found this morning who were supposed to go to my office. I don't know who they were supposed to go to my office. I'll make it up when I come back to the city. I'll get you somewhere. But that's what we have because we ran out, and we had to stop taking orders after just 20 minutes. So now we found 10. So for 10 people, you'll get the whole survival kit, 877-627-5065. But everybody can get the 3-hour definitive discussion with Matthew Stein and myself on what to do as individuals, as families, with or without a car, with or without limitations, with or without money. How do you survive if there's a solar flare that's bad, if there's a nuclear fallout that's bad? So now you can call 877-627-5065. Now, let's finish off here. Let's go over to Luann Panessi, who's standing by. Hi, Luann.
Hello, Gary. I have an email from one of your listeners from upstate who saw you in Woodstock, and she says, I propose we conduct a year-long study and give the people of Monsanto that support genetic engineering their own GMO food for 1 year, and let's see what happens to them. This way we know for sure if GMOs are safe or not, and who knows, if a couple of them drop dead in the process, at least we'd be aware. Let's campaign that they should put their money where their mouth is.
Well, that's interesting. So, in other words, we would only have GMOs eaten exclusively by those people who don't feel that there's any reason not to eat them, and then we could kind of watch and observe. Okay, well, why don't we start with politicians? Oh, I forgot. They're like rats. They could eat anything. They could eat feces and live, couldn't they? Okay, good. Thank you for that, Luann.
Okay.
This is from, and we're going to finish off our program today with this. This is from Joanne. And Joanne writes this. Hello, Gary. I have a dilemma, which I'm completely consumed by, and I'm hoping you can help. I don't vaccinate my children, and a few days ago, I was cornered and interrogated by a group of friends and neighbors. It was incredibly uncomfortable. They only allowed me to make 2 points while they made numerous arguments. They accused me of behaving in an irresponsible way and that I shouldn't trust anything I read on the Internet. Meanwhile, I literally slept 4 hours a night for months when researching this topic. Ironic, isn't it, that they assume anything coming from the FDA and CDC is the truth, and probably they never spent more than a couple of hours on this incredibly important issue. Anyway, I'm unable to provide them with all my sources because years ago I sent my laptop in for repair and the techs reformatted it without my permission and I lost all my data. I was hoping that if I provide them with what they perceive as credible sources that they will take it upon themselves to investigate the topic further on their own. I would like to have focused their attention on the fact that almost all of these diseases, with the exception of one, were completely eradicated on their own before the existence of vaccine. Can you help? Sure can, just today. First, look at two questions. Are vaccines safe and are they effective? And what is their proof from independent sources? You got to look at the independent literature. This is about Gardasil. Quote, Gardasil destroys girls' ovaries. Research on ovaries never considered, from Heidi Stevens. And it says, the British Medical Journal has published the case report of a healthy 16-year-old Australian girl whose womanhood appears to have been stolen by Gardasil vaccinations. She had been thrust into full-fledged menopause at age 16, her ovaries irrevocably shut down before becoming a woman. The authors of the study draw direct attention to the fact that though the girl has been thoroughly examined and tested, there is no known explanation other than the series of 3 Gardasil vaccinations she had been given. And making matters worse is that there were many others with such cases, but they are not being given the attention they need. So we have no evidence that Gardasil will prevent the cancers of the uterus that they are claiming. Here's the next one. This is from VaccineLiberationArmy.com. That's a great website, by the way. Gardasil deaths account for over 60% of all vaccine-related death reports. Quote, the FDA's approval of Merck's HPV vaccine Gardasil, and this is from Dr. Lucia Tomjankovic, who, by the way, I'll be in Seattle filming her tomorrow, and then Vancouver the next day. Tables in this study show, for example, that the Gardasil vaccine, this is from her, the PhD immunologist, quote, the Gardasil vaccine accounts for over 60% of all vaccine-related death reports. The Gardasil vaccine accounts for over 80% of all vaccine-related permanent disability reports. And this is from the actual excerpt, quote, Merck's HPV vaccine Gardasil failed and continues to fail to meet a single one of the 4 criteria required by the FDA for fast-track approval. In spite of this, Gardasil continues to be falsely promoted as if it already had post-phase 4 confirmatory trial approval and proven efficacy against cervical cancer. FDA and CDC rely exclusively on data provided by the manufacturer, disregarding the abundance of adverse events reported to the Vaccine Adverse Events Reporting System. Independent research studies, outcries from doctors who have the courage to speak out, and heartbreaking personal stories, the official soundbite from the FDA and CDC is that Gardasil is safe and effective and its benefits continue to outweigh its risks. And that is not the case. So here's what you do. Go up on the website, on my website, you will see 21 articles. All are fully, completely footnoted and scientifically referenced. They have been read by tens of millions of people worldwide. Take them down. Share them with your friends. Look at my testimony under oath that's up on the website. Share that with them. There was a whole panel of physicians, and not one of them challenged me on any of my statements. Look at the testimony I gave to a group of the top doctors in the state when we rallied at the Capitol in Albany. I gave them a 109-page report with hundreds of scientific references that the flu shot and the H1N1 were not scientifically proven to prevent the flu or were safe for anyone because they contain high levels of mercury, methylmercury, 24 micrograms. Again, I was not refuted. So we have all the evidence necessary to inform these people who did not want to know the truth. Hope that helps you. We're out of time. I want to thank you all for listening. Now it's time for Utrice Lead. Let's say hello to Utrice Lead, who's got 55 minutes ahead of her to inform you, inspire you, motivate you, and hopefully make you have a better day. Hi, Utrice.
Hello, Gary. How you doing? I like that reference to mice and politicians. You had the checkler here that they could eat anything and still survive.
Great.
Today we have an open forum again. We're following up. There's a lot of discussion that people want to have, and this is a good place to do it. So we'll continue our discussion from yesterday.
Great. We look forward to hearing you. In a moment, you treat me.